Meandering in the margins of medicine, it's the Short Code Podcast.
Welcome back to the Short Code Podcast. I'm Dave Etler, and I am over the moon. Because, and I'm sure once you find out why, you will feel the same way. Because I am joined today by Cole Cheney, Corbin Weaver, Ethan Craig, Greg Woods, Casey McCleary, and Eileen Sanduk.
Yeah, thank you.
It's a symphony.
Yes, it is. It's a magical time, I think. Don't you think?
It is.
I hope you had a restful Thanksgiving, guys.
We did. And You brought us a present, it looks like, Dave.
I did. You want to break that open? I won an office bingo thing at the last OSAC all staff meeting.
Ooh.
And that bottle there we're opening.
Well, describe it for us though. This is a
Well, it's quite posh.
Okay.
It's a bottle of fine 2014 vintage Welch's sparkling
vineyard.
Grape juice.
Uh-huh.
And from which I've removed the label and affixed my own.
And which says?
It says the good stuff, because that's what it is.
Naturally.
Truth in advertising.
We'll be the judges.
I feel embarrassed. I feel underdressed.
Yes.
Yeah, where's your three-piece suit?
Clearly.
Oh, I didn't realize we had cups, and I thought we were just going to like pass it around the circle.
Yep.
Yeah.
We've learned better from infectious disease and other courses.
Things get crazy on this podcast.
I am but an M1.
That's true.
So I thought I would share it with you guys because, you know.
Well, thank you.
Were you humbly bragging there about winning your contest there, Dave?
I don't believe in humble bragging.
You don't believe in it?
I it's fine.
What would you put a brag versus a humble brag? Which
that
would
wasn't
you
a humble brag. All I had to do was like match up the snowman with and the guy on the skis and the... You know, it's like bingo, office bingo.
Dave, someone called a segue.
By the OSAC Fun Committee.
It wasn't a humble brag, it was
they have a
segue.
A fun committee?
Oh. Yes, they do.
Let's talk
humble
brags.
It's a lot
brags.
Of fun.
Wow.
So, yeah, welcome back to the show. You guys had a week off, a whole week, right?
Yeah.
Did you actually take advantage of it, or did you, like,
it
study the whole week
glorious.
Or
glorious.
Oh.
That's coming from the M1s.
M2s?
M2s are kind of freaking a little bit.
Yeah.
We had an exam on Monday and then an exam on Tuesday following break. So, and then one on Friday. So we were a little stressed.
I wish I could, cool. I wish I had the ability to bleep out swears because that is effed up right there. That is wrong.
They put you through the ringer. Maybe you can speak to this. I think
I remember
M2,
last
just...
year. Yeah. Yeah. Both finals weeks are just awful. First semester and second semester. The way they structure it is just nonstop and you get like 2 days in between sometimes. And
so your break was like, had quotes around it and an asterisk.
Yeah, last year, yeah, both breaks, it seemed like.
Wow.
Yeah.
But it's still a break, which I think is more than some M3 and M4s can say. Is that correct?
That is true, yeah.
So,
yeah, I mean, most M3s and 4s do get some sort of a Christmas break. And normally you get Thanksgiving off, but they don't get the full week. They don't get the full week of spring break, all those things.
So I can't cry on your shoulders, what you're saying.
No.
Okay.
Go to Plan B.
The last time we got together, I mentioned that I went to the Doctor Who. I was going to go to the Doctor Who convention in beautiful Lombard, Illinois. Mm-hmm. And I have to say that it was pretty, as I predicted, it was pretty interesting. Filled with people who I would not be able to describe as neurotypical, but it was great. I mean it's fine. I mean neurotypical in the sense that. In the sense that, you know, like, people are different, you know? And it's like serious. It's just such an interesting group of people to be around. And, you know, when I think of myself as neurotypical, I think of myself as kind of boring.
So there's a Van Gogh quote, and it goes, the paved road is easy or something, but no flowers can. Or normality is a paved road, but no flowers grow there.
Ooh.
So what you're saying is there are a lot of flowers.
Exactly.
You're burying the lead here, Dave. Which I think the most adorable scene is Dave's kids were on a panel concerning the Whovian Festival.
Really?
Yeah, they were. They my wife convinced them to be on the kids panel to talk about the show and she said later that they did a good job. They may have been the only.
Neurotypical
children on the stage. The facilitator looked as though she did not expect it to go quite this way. So, but yeah, a lot of people in costume, Daleks running around. My son, even my son had his blinky, flashy facial prosthetic on.
From the Cyberman thing.
And it worked out real well, and people took pictures, and so it was cool.
That's
what I did.
Them.
I did have to drive back to Iowa and then return to Lombard because we forgot a suitcase full of medication.
Darn it.
That was not great. I consider not telling anybody that.
Should have just borrowed a TARDIS.
Exactly. They're just lying around.
Yeah. I feel like the medical community can appreciate the extent you went to be compliant
with
medication.
Yeah, well,
good point.
Exactly.
Good tie-in.
Exactly.
Good save.
But I was talking with Aline yesterday in the hallways after an exam, I think.
I can confirm that.
Or was it before an exam? Anyway.
Before the exam.
About the noisome habit medical students sometimes have of when the exam is over, this is computer-based testing, when the exam is over, comparing their scores. Mm. And I think Aline sort of felt.
We talked about a lot of things, and I wanted to know specifically the thing you wanted to talk about.
Well, that's what I want to talk about. Okay. And the humble brag also.
Give me some examples here.
Like, what are you mysterious?
What do you hear?
I'm surprised I did so well.
Okay, that's pretty humble.
Yeah.
Braggy.
Yeah.
I
did better than I deserve.
Oh.
But you could have, barely eked out a passing. Like, that seems kind of ambiguous to me. Yeah. Or is it still humble brag? I don't know.
It's a milder humble brag.
It's a mild humble brag.
I think the common one is I just learned that last night. I can't believe I did okay or whatever.
Yeah.
It's like, I barely studied, but I still did okay.
I hate I barely studied.
Oh, I know. I hate that.
Ugh. Is that even possible? I don't understand.
Supposedly. At least people claim that. I don't know.
I don't think it's possible.
I mean, given the talent
of the people
here. So you think
they're full of it?
No, I think it is entirely possible, given the talent at Carver College of Medicine. But...
he says, humbly bragging.
No, I was
given the talent we have here.
I was never one of those.
Not including myself.
No.
He's hoping that one of us will say, oh no, Greg, you are ultra talented.
You don't have to lead me on. No.
Okay.
What about, is this a humble brag? I think it borders when the person will say, oh, I'm so weird or I'm so awkward, concerning their interest in Star Wars or, so you guys seem readily... acceptance of your being Whovians, right?
Yeah.
But
okay.
If you ever sit here and apologize to me and go, oh, I'm so weird, I like Doctor Who, would that be a weird humble brag, or is that bordering on some other social phenomenon?
Oh, I think it might be another.
I think it's different.
Would that Are you familiar be? With this thing, though, that I'm describing?
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. I think it's a non-nerdy person appropriating nerd culture.
Okay.
So it's a poser.
Yeah. A poser. Okay, so that might not be a humble brag.
Okay.
Yes. Well, so I think it could be is that, oh, look how different I am. Look how interesting I am. I'm weird or awkward or just like emphasizing that they have this unique characteristic.
I can see that, especially because nerd culture is becoming,
relatively mainstream.
It's very, yeah. I think it's very mainstream, actually.
Sure.
I mean, there's a lot of people who would admit to, like being Pokemon nerds and things like that who otherwise, you might not expect.
Yeah, so that's kind of an interesting, like, I'm unique, but not in too unique a way.
Well, I welcome them, those people.
As opposed to the humble braggers. Shun them.
I don't have a problem with the occasional humble brag. I mean, sometimes you got to toot your own horn, nobody else is going to do it, right?
Except your mother.
In my case, yes.
By the way, that bottle was quite nice that you won for us.
Oh, so, I didn't. Did everybody get their drink? We should have a toast.
Absolutely.
Oops.
We didn't toast
it. Yeah, it's a little bit late for that.
Well, there's an analog of the. So the other thing you mentioned, Aline, was the sharing of the sharing of scores, which you don't particularly.
That drives me nuts.
That seems not. That's not kosher. I'm really surprised people do that.
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever heard someone tell me their score. I've never told anyone my score.
No. Well, it doesn't happen a lot, but it does happen when people share scores.
So how does it happen? Like, how do you,
I don't do it. I don't know.
No, but, but you've heard it. How do people do it?
I think,
And why is it bad? in your opinion?
Why is it bad for employees who work together to share each other's salaries, basically? No good can come of it. Because someone's going to feel really good, and then someone's going to feel really bad.
So you're saying this is analogous to that?
Just to argue your analogy, the transparency of knowing each other's salaries, saves like men and women from getting paid different things.
Ooh.
But I think
So that's a place where the analogy falls down a lot.
That's where the analogy falls. But I think that I have a problem with sharing scores mainly because it just has. There's no value in the sense that you're not learning anything. You're not helping anyone.
You're basically learning how good you are relative to your classmates.
Right, and you can learn that from the average. So you don't have to, it's just making people feel bad, really. And you're not going to learn anything, really, from knowing someone else's score.
Does anybody feel not at all okay about it?
I have the one exception, which is I have a friend who, he just, after this one exam that would always kill us, he always seemed like a little too good of a mood. Wouldn't say anything. But what I did is I said, I don't know if you do well or not in this class. You always seem really happy afterwards. Could you tell me what you do? And then I'm going to try to do that. Mm-hmm. So then I did it, and it worked really well on my next exam.
Oh, well, hit us up.
Darn.
So whatever he,
unless you don't want to blow the curve.
Yeah, but I thought it was nice of him to give me, because I was studying sort of the wrong way for this class.
Oh.
And so that's the only situation I could see this being helpful, but that is when it was solicited. So I think if someone says, do you do well in this class or poorly, or do you not want to tell me? Second conundrum I have for you guys. I do have people ask me once in a while, hey, I'm interested in medical school. I actually got denied once or twice. Just curious, would you mind telling me your MCAT score? People will say that to me.
Oh, yeah.
Where do you guys fall on that?
I've been asked that as well, and I normally try to deflect it as much as I can, just because, I tell them, first off, that that's not the most important thing.
Mm-hmm.
That is a part of it, and when we had the admissions director in here, that was only a small piece of a much larger picture that they take. So I try to tell them, don't focus on that as much, because everybody's going to be different. You're going to have people who get low MCAT scores get in. You're going to have people with high MCAT scores that don't get in, and then vice versa. So...
Our audience of one back there agrees that her facial expression told the story, which is I don't like.
You can always default to the average too and say, the school typically admits this MCAT. I think that's one of the strong ways to go about it.
Mm-hmm. There's an analogy among business people. Or even people that help run medical schools, and that is the sort of talking about how busy we are.
Mm. Oh, that's a thing.
Do you know what I'm saying? Like, oh, how's it going? Oh, I'm busy.
Competition to be the most busy.
I am busy. Things are going. It's going crazy around here. Woo! Woo!
That was a big thing in the honors communities too. I was in the honors program in my undergrad, and we all lived on a floor together in the dorms, and it was just constantly like, oh, I'm so busy. No, I'm so busy. Oh, yeah. Oh, you're really busy. Constant.
The refusal to acknowledge that for every person in every job out there, there are times when it's quieter than others, and it's okay to say, things are a little quiet right now. I'm just catching up. Kind of thing.
It also acknowledges inefficiency, I think, if you're constantly busy, right? I mean, isn't that ultimately...
That's how I feel, but some people are really... have a lot invested in...
their head spinning.
Feeling, always being busy, because it means... I don't know what it means to them. Maybe it means that, they're valuable in some way, maybe... and I guess everybody must have their different interpretation of how, busyness translates to worth, but...
It's like you're...
I feel like if I can... I don't know. This is my personal take. If I can make myself less busy, it means that I can do things. I can do the next thing.
Like create a podcast.
Well, yes.
This is outside your job description. I mean, that is a classic part of it.
I think this is probably partially cultural, we value busyness in America.
We do.
It's hugely
productivity.
Cultural.
Mm-hmm.
We do. Unfortunately, these numbers are the only thing often that we have to decide whether or not we're doing what we need to be doing. I mean, it's the only feedback we get. And so it's not all that surprising that y'all focus on, the score, the number. Even though we try to tell... Yeah, it's got to be frustrating.
Yeah.
Even though the college says... Or, your professors will say, it's not all about the score, but...
But in terms of, you know, looking at how you're doing in medicine, at this school, at least, that's kind of how it is sometimes, especially when you've got a class that only has, you know, four tests in it, and those are the only scores that you get from that class. In the end, it's kind of a black and white of, okay, well, here you are, or you're down there. All right, that's it.
You have to take a conscious step back, though, from that and say, okay, well, this isn't the, you know, this isn't the be-all and end-all. This number right. isn't the whole story.
We got to explain, though, to people who are not here at Iowa, which is the majority of our listeners, the structure of this grading system, which is that, first of all, it's pass, no pass. 70% and above is a mm-hmm. pass.
Yep.
Although for the M1s, I think it might be 80% now. Is that true?
Not for every class.
Depends okay. on the class.
Depends on the class. Secondly, in terms of comparing, one would not have to actually ask around to find what the scores are because most tests we take have a bar distribution graph of how many people got each score in quintiles, or not even quintiles, like deciles maybe, I think, yeah. in 5% blocks. So you can see, well, 10 people got 100%, 5 people got 9%, and then it distributes the mean, mm-hmm. median, mode. And so that is the way you really gauge where you're at relative to the class.
You don't get that immediately, though. You get that.
As soon as your test comes out, typically those are published along with the test score. Oh. Your individual score is sort of a more aggregate score.
But this is after... This is not the raw score that you
it's
get
not like
when,
real
you're,
time.
When you're... Yeah, you can't...
Yeah, no.
No, you wouldn't know, because, yeah, that'd be impossible, because people are still taking the test. But that is the way I think a lot of us... I mean, I think it'd be naive to say all of us don't maybe get our score back and then check, where am I sort of in the class range? It's very important. You know, if you do really poorly, maybe you're kind of secretly hoping that the rest of the class kind of... You know, it was just hard material, as opposed to, I did poorly yeah. and the whole class did really well. What am I missing?
Yeah, I think that's why it's, you know, valuable for us to understand where each other... are sitting, as well as especially from the administrative standpoint, like, did we actually teach this well? Like, where is the distribution? Mm-hmm. And am I in the bulk of it? Am I with that group that either did or did not understand it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because there are some weeks that one test to the next in the same class can differ by an average of 10% or more. Yep. So it can make a difference.
Yeah, and I know, like, I walked out of my first Rubenstein test, the very
biochemistry.
Hardcore mm-hmm. biochemistry test, and immediately looked up what to do if you fail out of medical school.
Yeah.
But then I started talking to
other
people.
How many of you have
people.
Looked up this thing at some
the
point?
The hands are flying.
Oh, yep. Aline will not confess to having
why?
Looked up.
Why are you looking at her, Dave?
The weather's so bad today. That's what I
respond. Humble brag.
The point was that it was comforting to hear, in that case, that other people also did very poorly.
Actually, that's the only reason that I would want to hear about other scores, is to be like, okay, I'm normal.
Yeah.
But then there's
But you'll
potential...
find that out. You'll find that out when the distribution comes out. So.
Yeah. In the case of a poor test score, sometimes you need that assurance, like, right away before you walk yourself off the dropping out of med school cliff.
Yeah, you know. Exactly.
Oh, and a cliff it is indeed.
We'll be back in just a second on the Short Code Podcast.
The Art of Medicine podcast explores topics in medicine through the lens of the arts and social sciences. Learn about an epileptic woman who created a virtual reality grand mal seizure, what doctors can learn from jazz musicians, and the experience of sexual assignment in a medicalized body. Download us on iTunes and visit us at www.theartofmedicinepodcast.com. We are a member of the Vocalis Network, the podcast network for medical students. Please listen to our partner podcasts at vocalisnetwork.wix.com/listen.
We're back on the Short Code Podcast. Greg?
Yes.
What do you have to tell us?
Well, as we hopefully all know, smoking makes you a little less cool to some people, but a new study has come out and said that it may actually make you slightly less of a man, if you are a man to start with, that is, than others. This puzzled look is just... I love this.
I'm imagining the ways that that could be.
Yes. So, what the study did is it looked at the actual chromosomes in blood, in smokers and non-smokers. And what they found out, that a good chunk of people, if they've been smoking for a long time, actually lose the Y chromosome from their cells. So first off, I must say, this does not make you have any outward effects of being... less of a man.
Yes, you don't turn into
no, you
a
don't
woman.
Turn into a woman or anything like this. The main concern that a lot of people have is they think that this has something to do with actually anti-cancer. It is keeping that Y chromosome in there may have benefits on the cancer front, because those who have lost it seem to have a little predilection to getting cancer more. Wow. Now, the question is this more of a canary in the mine sort of thing of saying, you know, that the reason you're getting this cancer is because all these damage to the cells, or is it losing the Y chromosome that has a bearing in you getting cancer to begin with. Now, another interesting thing is, for those who stop smoking, their levels actually will return to normal after a while, to those equal to people who have never smoked. So it is reversible. So there is hope.
So is what's happening... Why does it go away? Do we know that? Why?
We don't know that yet. Okay. No. Now, this is something...
I mean, the first thing I thought of was, like, maybe the cellular mechanisms that take care of errors in the genetic mm-hmm. code, you know, it's basically deleting that information that's been corrupted by smoking.
So
that sounds to me like it could be, but
it is a possibility. The initial aspects
but that
of
the
study,
whatever wherever blood comes from, like the bone marrow, right? Mm-hmm. So we're talking about red cells.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Those aren't as affected, and so they can make new blood. And
right. So this goes back actually a long time to when they first theorized that this was happening, but these studies have been more recent confirming this fact and actually giving us numbers to how many will lose this, and they say there's more to come. They need to broaden the study a little bit and also figure out exactly why the Y does get kicked out. So.
Nice. Well, cool.
Well, traditional, okay, genetics pros here. Traditionally, I've been taught that the Y chromosome has essentially nothing on it. It's almost a place marker. Is this? Would you agree with me?
That I've heard that before. Yes.
So maybe that's an interesting aspect of this. Maybe there's a bit more of a functional aspect of this Y than we previously thought.
And that's something that we've seen in a lot of aspects of our
genetic
analysis.
Why do people want to make us men feel more and more useless? Now they're going to take away my chromosome as being important?
You're doing it to yourself, man. No, I mean, how many times have we said good chunks of our genome don't do anything?
And then
the more that we look at them, those introns and exons, we find out, oh, actually...
We splice them, and there's different ways we can...
There's not just junk DNA that is leftover stuff, but if we take that out, that does have effects. We just didn't know that that was a thing.
Sure.
It reminds me, only because we're talking about men and women, I guess, of the other story I read this week, and I decided not to talk about it because the more I looked into it, the more sketchy the original article I read. But it was basically, you know, women who are taking anti-androgenic oral contraceptives have, they are better at some mental tasks than women who don't take anti-androgenic oral contraceptives or people who are cycling normally.
Hmm. Wow.
And in fact, there was a difference in gray matter and things like that. And I thought, well, again, this is why women are smarter than me.
Neurogenesis, though, is a big... So SSRIs, antidepressants, that we normally recognize, we just thought they affected the neurotransmitter levels, but now, you know, studies are showing there's actually new neurons emerging after 3, 4, 6 weeks of treatment. So
hence the delay.
Yeah, these drugs are actually causing more macro-level changes than we ever mm-hmm. thought.
I was incensed this week at something I read. I was shocked to read... That this is from NPR's website, that about the treatment of anaphylactic shock and how terrible anaphylactic reactions. I don't know if anaphylactic shock is a true misnomer. About how basically half of internal medicine doctors don't know that epinephrine should be the first line treatment, and in the emergency room only 80% of people experiencing anaphylaxis aren't getting epinephrine.
What are they getting instead?
Yeah.
Do we know?
I think they're getting wait and see.
Ugh.
Yeah. And so, I don't know, it just feels like there's no excuse for this. I mean, how could this not be? I mean, I feel like this is common knowledge even among people who...
Every movie has that scene.
I know, it's
stabs him in the heart.
Yeah.
Or the leg.
Well, that's one of the... So.
Oh, that's the other one.
That yes.
Oh, I would be their resident.
He's like... What? Cole walks into my son's
he's got
ER
like
room and like stabs him in the heart with a hypodermic syringe. I'm like, what the...
No! I saw this in a movie!
Well, it turns out that one possible explanation is that epinephrine's use in treating cardiac arrest means it's associated by doctors with life-ending events. Hmm. And you know, there's just sort of association with epinephrine that's inhibiting their wanting to use it in this.
Isn't untreated anaphylaxis a potentially life-ending event anyway?
Yeah.
I have a funny side note about that. Lean in.
Oh, okay.
So before I came to med school, I thought epinephrine was pronounced Epinephrine.
It's like when I wrote my first research paper and I tried to use the word paradigm and I was like reading it to my mom to proofread and I go, paradigm.
Catechus is always a good one.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Male kahimp. Sorry, it's a serial reference.
All right, so let's talk flu vaccination.
All right, go.
Mm. Just saw a poll. They asked the public. I think it was like one of those classic USA Today polls, you know, with big block letters and images for guys like me that can't read the entire article.
Yeah.
Only 51% said they would actually get the flu vaccine. And the other 49, or it was like 48 said no, and then another 1% were undecided. Where do we fall here? I think.
Well,
get
question
it.
Though.
Why?
Was,
get
hold
it.
On,
Why?
Hold on. Was this poll done after the news came out that this year's flu vaccine may not be as effective?
That's why it was in conjunction with that.
Okay. All right. So that might have depressed it a little bit, but still, I think we all advocate. Please get it.
Please get it.
Please.
But
some of us can't get the flu vaccine, and so we depend on the people who get
Ooh,
the rest of the herd
vaccine.
Explain that. So you can't. Do you have an allergy?
I had Guillain-Barré syndrome. I think I've mentioned this before. I had Guillain-Barré syndrome, and it's contraindicated, although I'm not convinced that the science is totally there.
You want to roll the dice on the show?
I'm not sure I want to roll the dice. Yeah.
Let's do it, Dave.
I don't want to roll the dice at all.
He plays fast and loose.
But yeah, I mean, those of us who, you know, are told you can't get it or you shouldn't get it.
Well, there are some people who have a legitimate egg allergy.
Yeah.
And can't get it.
Yeah.
Well, now there's the nasal.
The flu mist.
Which I'm all about, because I get the weird pass out with the shots issue we've talked previous shows. Flu mist is awesome, though. I think it's good for 13 to 49-year-olds, so, you know, a majority of the flu-giving and receiving population can get alternative treatment.
You know what I want to get? The vaccine
That's
I want
to
get?
Know.
Shingles. What? I want to get the shingles vaccine.
Okay.
Because I have a relative who has two relatives, actually, now, who have these shingles really, really bad, and it sounds absolutely horrible.
And you don't have to have it. I mean, that's a great, you know, you get the vaccine.
Yeah.
But then what's weird is that they say it's indicated for people 50 and older.
Yep.
Not there yet.
Did you not have chicken pox as a kid?
I did have chicken pox, but that doesn't...
Kids do not
that
have
means that, that means that I could get shingles.
Well, here's what I say. You know, keep working towards it. You'll reach 50 someday.
Thank you.
keep it on your wish list.
Thank you.
I
will continue to travel around the sun until I reach the age.
While we advocate for the flu virus vaccine, I think, you know, sort of the negative against it, people see it as, well, the CDC basically, they're like weathermen. Like, sometimes they get it right and sometimes they don't. Which particular H3N2 strain, substrain of flu. That being said, Why not take a risk for the positive, right?
Well, even as I understand this particular year, it's like a third of the strains or something like that. It's like a fraction of the strain, the strains that it protects for.
It's the one they predict will be the most common and the most pathological.
Right.
But it's not going to hurt you
to
get
your
flu shot.
Yeah. They might be wrong, and that's we're all acknowledging that. But that being said, why not? The downside's very low and the upside's very high. And flu is actually can kill people, you know, anyone that's immunocompromised,
flu kills
older.
A lot of people.
So why not
more
maybe
people
do
than Ebola.
There you go.
What amazes me is people who vilify parents who don't vaccinate their kids and then they don't get the flu vaccine.
Oh yeah.
I'm like, that's what? I don't
know. Yeah. And the final stat here, estimates from the CDC. That seems like they should have studied. Someone else should have studied this. But 98% of the children who die from the flu have not been vaccinated for the flu. So why risk it?
There you go. Mm-hmm.
The good news also is that I think our employee health flu vaccine campaign was like 80% of people for University of Iowa hospitals and clinics.
Yeah, absolutely.
Vaccination, so good. Not bad.
Although it should be like in this environment.
Thank you, University of Iowa hospitals and clinics employees for protecting me.
Yes.
HC. Probably should have been 100, but
I mean, that's, you know,
ideally
1 in 5 is still not getting it.
It's better than nothing.
Better
it's
than better, population better levels.
Yeah.
Well, what we don't actually know is how many of those people are being told that they shouldn't, like me.
True.
You know,
good point.
I'm not really sure we know, and it's not over yet. You know, they're still pushing. So, you guys, it turns out that a third of plastic surgeons have seen an increase in elective surgery requests. Because patients are dissatisfied with their image on social media. The selfie effect is from 2012 to 2013, Rhinoplasty apparently increased 10%. Hair transplant 7%. Eyelid surgery 6%.
The solution is don't take pictures of yourself.
Yeah, well,
or Photoshop.
We have to. How is that even? How can one even survive in the social media age?
I haven't had a picture taken of me in 6 months.
That's a you problem.
Yeah. No, I'm just saying.
I'm sorry.
How is that even possible? Don't you have friends to take unflattering photos of you and post them when you don't want them to?
Or do you have a radar of where the cameras are?
Because I can always just I sure do.
Yeah, there
I
you go.
I avoid the camera.
I am the person who takes the unflattering pictures.
Yeah, that's what I always say. I always say I'm the one with the camera, mm-hmm. So I don't have a ton of pictures taken of me.
There are like 3,000 pictures of me on Facebook.
Can we get at the bigger issue, though, here? Which is self-image and positive.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Yes. And maybe appreciating something.
Okay.
That's actually, the bigger issue.
But
so I have a story that kind of ties into this.
We'll
come back to that.
We'll come back.
Yeah. So go ahead.
What I was going to say is people don't really understand how cameras work. This is part of
it. I was going to say, instead of more plastic surgery, how about more photography classes?
Well, I mean, the thing... I didn't think of that. Exactly. I mean, the thing is, the mm-hmm. image that you see in the mirror, the one that you're most used to, is not the same image that other people see and that cameras see. That's reversed. So, in other words, you don't know what you look like.
It's so
you
true.
Have never seen your
you
face
have never
with your
seen
eyes.
Your face with your own
you've
eyes.
You just triggered like 1,000 people's insecurities.
Are you saying that I'm not pretty?
You
that whole thing That's was exactly just
you are
subtle.
You are gorgeous, you Ethan. I've been meaning to tell you that you are smoking.
We need to put him through that celebrity look-alike thing that we did.
Oh my
we
gosh.
Got some good results from that.
You just like
good.
Yours.
Really did.
Ridiculous.
I don't even remember mine. Was I Drew Barrymore?
Yeah. Something like that. Something like that.
I mean, we were all thinking
who was the queen?
Ben Quarshie was Queen Elizabeth.
Queen Elizabeth. There you go. Uncanny.
That was great.
All right, what's this tie-in's news story?
Okay, so talk about self-image. This was a guy from Dorset, England, who was not worried about the fact that his nose had been messed up loads of times over the years because he'd been playing rugby. It had gotten broken so many times that he hadn't been able to smell in some 20 years. But he was not deterred. He did not go out and get a rhinoplasty. He did not get plastic surgery. Instead, he played more rugby, and he got hit in the nose the other day, and his sense of smell returned just in time for him to detect a gas leak nearby the rugby pitch.
Whoa.
So he called it in.
That's
people
miraculous.
Came out, sealed the gas leak, and he said, I still remember what gas smelled like. I can't believe that it happened of all the days that day. Who knows how many saved.
So wait, he literally got smacked in the face and then immediately was like, there's a gas leak.
Yeah, pretty much.
Whoa.
This is the same logic as the Gilligan's Island hit on the coconut once, you go into a stupor,
yep.
Hit again, you're right back
you
to
regain
normal.
Your yeah, memory.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, this is solid sound.
I'm so glad that Gilligan's Island is that Gilligan's Island is coming to the show today. I don't know why.
Or those people you read about these stories too, people that all of a sudden they wake up speaking a foreign language.
Oh yeah.
That
yeah.
one blows my mind even more, but smell is a very
yeah. Or you know, or people get hit by lightning and all of a sudden they, you know, they can do different things with their memory. And yeah, they're just it's intriguing.
They're piano prodigies
yep.
like overnight.
Yeah, it's savant syndrome, you know, yeah. savant
we could all be so lucky.
I love savant syndrome. It's fascinating.
Tells you how much we don't know about the brain.
It's amazing.
It's mm-hmm. true.
I think this was more of a case, this is my guess, of the nasal passageway actually being reopened.
Realigned.
As opposed to being, you know,
sure.
deviated septum and all that stuff from being whacked in scrums all these years. But you never know. I don't know.
I think what's fascinating to me about sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, so did he have anything to say about his self-appearance or his self-esteem after the incident?
Mm-hmm. After the incident, no. I have not heard. I would have to think that knowing...
Except that he smells really bad, it turns out.
Oh. All these years. I haven't been bathing.
He had no idea.
Oh, man.
Like, why didn't people
tell me?
I stink.
I think the self-satisfaction of saving the wonderful, hometown picturesque
hero.
Town of Dorset. Yes. I think that's good.
I have an opportunity.
Dorset's more of a region, but.
I have an opportunity of study for medical students, and that is in the realm of simulation. Medical school simulation science, basically. So I read an interesting article about Carla Pugh, who is a surgeon at the University of Washington and director of UW's clinical simulation program. And, you know, so we have this thing here called Harvey, right? Mm-hmm. What's Harvey? Yep.
RV is a cardiovascular simulator. It's a special dummy, basically, to put it simply, that can mimic all these different heart sounds and
I have been
conditions.
Called that before, special dummy.
Yeah, really?
So it's a torso. Harvey's a torso, right?
Yeah, I mean, he's got a head and stuff, too. But
right, so that's what I think of when I think of simulation. The other thing I think of is the simulated patients that we use to teach and test students' clinical skills and all that kind of stuff. But what this woman has started focusing on is the use of various unconventional materials to simulate the feel of organs and things like that. Because, you know, one day she was in she was working in the emergency department and, you know, somebody's heart had stopped and the resident was trying to get it started through cardiac massage and, you know, it started and then it stopped and they couldn't figure out what was going on. And finally, she reached in there and touched it and felt a clot. And as soon as they took that clot out, the heart was like, oh, bam, I'm ready to go. And, and she thought to herself, well, is the problem here that we just don't know, that the students just don't know what clots feel like? She sort of has made it her mission to engage the sense of touch in learning. And so she does things like, you know, she'll get like a bunch of silicone and put some lentils in it and some, you know, clay nodules and like, just sounds like she's doing sort of unconventional things with touch. And, you know, she probably, and I think she does some of the things that we usually think about, you know, the higher tech things, like, you know, plugging computers into mannequins and doing that too. But I thought it was interesting, this idea that, you know, I'll just throw some lentils in there. And I think I should probably say that the context of the lentils is that she was trying to simulate breast tissue and fibroids and then within that a tumor, because she noticed that about 15% of people couldn't detect that, you know, that tumor amongst all the fibroids. And so I thought that was pretty cool. So anyway, what I'm trying to say is, if you want to make a mark in research, it seems like simulation would be a really good way to go in this current, because like sensors, microprocessors, all this stuff has become so cheap and so accessible to, you know, to the learner that, you know, it seems like an awesome thing to get involved with.
I birthed a simulated baby at Des Moines University.
That's cool. I birthed a baby.
And it was incredible. And they give you a bunch of silicon gel to make sure that it comes out rather than creating too much friction on the baby head.
Uh-huh.
And you get the proper pose. And the mom, you can see her heart monitor, and she's kind of screaming a little bit, this robot mom. And a little robot baby
sounds
comes
terrifying.
Out. Yeah, it was interesting. I mean, it's something like you'd never get to do, nor would you get trusted to do it at this stage in my medical education.
So explain to me this torso. I mean, is it an entire person?
It was an entire mother, yes. Robot mom. Although I think this, so there's other ones that, for example, you can do blood draws on their bicep, and there's all sorts of, this one was, most of the mechanical functionality was below the waist.
Are you sure you weren't accidentally in a scene for the new Terminator movie coming up? Because that's really what it sounded like.
You could accidentally walk onto a movie.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I wish.
Every once in a while around here, I see a cart full of, like, butts moving down the hallway.
Yeah.
Being pushed down the hallway, and I'm like, oh.
Yep.
Have you gotten to that?
Doing simulator
stuff. Second semester?
Second semester.
We haven't done pelvic or rectal yet in M2 year.
It's on its way. Get ready. It's coming down the hallway.
We're looking at our future.
It's a blast.
That's right.
Yeah.
So this reminds me of, all I can think of is those old Halloween things where they have a box and they're like, put your hand in the box and feel the organs.
The
and
eyeballs.
It's spaghetti. Or, yeah, the eyeballs. Yeah. And it's peeled grapes. But that's all I can think of.
Actually, that's brilliant. You know, like, I think you had your start, you know?
Yeah.
You could get involved in this. You could make some real... waves.
I do desperately want to go to University of Washington, so...
Do you?
There you go. All right. Do.
Well, look up Carla Pugh. She's,
I want to get back to Seattle.
She sounds pretty cool. I'll post a video. I don't know. She's giving a talk. It's not, you know, the most exciting video because it's like an academic conference kind of thing. And she does have a TED talk out there, but I couldn't find the link.
It's also a cool comment on the direction. Medicine, I think, took a hard swing towards the hard sciences and... that was where American medicine was going, the lab values, the EKGs.
You're right.
And it's taken a swing back towards, you know, the European style mm-hmm. of medicine education really emphasizes the touch, the primary care doctor who sits there, interviews the patient, and asks, what do you think is wrong with you? And that's a cool, this seems to be more focused on that again.
Well, the other thing that she said influenced her was when she was a resident, she was in, I think it was a prostatectomy or something like that. And all she could see, no, she was a medical student. All she could see during this procedure was like the back of the surgeon's hand in the incision. And she was just standing there for hours. And the only thing that I think saved her and that got her started on this path was basically saying, so what are you doing in there? And the surgeon was kind enough to say, oh, well, I mean, here, go ahead, you know, because she spoke up during that, you know, when you're really not, I mean, you know, I think a lot of med students probably feel like you're not supposed to say anything. But she spoke up and the surgeon was happy to say, oh, yeah, reach in here and this is what I'm feeling. And, you know, she didn't know, you know, she did that. I think I read that she did that and she, you know, still didn't know what she was feeling, but at least at that moment, you know, there was the germ of that, you know, that sort of experience that made her, that put her on this path, which I think is really cool. You never know what is going to put you on your path.
What you doing?
So, yeah, exactly. What's going on?
So, let's talk about the missing brains of Texas.
Oh.
So, University of Texas thought for a couple of days that they lost this huge, like half their collection, 100 brains in jars just disappeared. Nobody knows where they went.
George, where'd you put the brains?
The what?
I thought you had them.
That is basically what was happening. So they were calling around. They thought maybe Mayo Clinic had some of them or, you know, some of the other places. But it was all these really actually wonderful pathologic specimens left over from the state mental hospital that were collected between the 50s and 70s. And they finally figured out today, much to my despair, that they had all been destroyed.
Oh,
no.
And it was, I think they were cleaning out like biochemical wastes and hazards and stuff. And I think, you know, 15, 20 years ago, and all these beautiful brains. And
I can't imagine how many mental patients suffered for them to collect those brains.
How do you make that mistake, like, too? Like, them brains over there, we don't need those.
We don't need the brains. They ain't using them anymore.
Yeah. I don't get it. No.
I don't know what happened, but they now think that they've been destroyed.
Oh, wait, they think they've been
destroyed. Well, they're pretty sure.
Oh, okay.
The news report that I read. I'll keep you updated if I hear any more about it. I'm following this case very closely.
I had a moment of hope there where we might find them on the side of the road somewhere.
Oh.
Well, I mean, there's an analogous story. Actually, so in the old days, before cameras, digital cameras became ubiquitous, they used to
ophthalmologists.
Thank you. I had a little stroke there. Ophthalmologists would draw sketches of the retina, and they were kind of works of art in a way. They would be very complex drawings and with different colors, and there were standards, and you know, you sort of drew out the structures. And that, you know, ultimately that was supplanted by technology where they would just take a shot of your back of your eye and there was the record. So apparently these here, you know, after many years, they got misplaced and you know, they weren't particularly of therapeutic value anymore, but they're kind of cool. And then one day, apparently they got a call, from this warehouse in Cedar Rapids, and they were like, we got all these drawings. What do you, you know, can we get rid of them? What do you want to do with them? And it turned out that they were these missing fundus drawings.
That's cool.
And, so they brought them for our yearly writing conference and, you know, put them up and you know, they were just pretty cool. We actually used one for the cover of our, Examine Life, literary journal. And, I mean, these things unfortunately go missing and they're kind of, in that case, kind of cool. And your case, kind of important. So
it's probably some clerical error.
Yeah. Well,
yeah, we can get rid of these. We don't need these brains.
Yeah.
We have 200 other brains.
Done with that. The Short Code Podcast is brought to you by the Writing and Humanities Program in the Carver College of Medicine Student Government. If you like what you heard today on the Short Code Podcast, leave us a review on iTunes or Stitcher so we can help build our already fantastic audience. This is super important, so help out a podcast, okay? Before we go, we'd like to invite you to tell us your moment of truth. If something strange or wonderful happened to you, if you're annoyed or pleased about something, go to theshortcode.com. Leave us a message. Do follow us and talk to us on Twitter so you can stay up to date on what's happening at the margins of medicine. The show is made possible by this strange world we live in. Our executive producers are Dave Etler and Jason Lewis. Our opening theme is by Dude Skywalker, and our closing music is by C2C. Talk to you in 1 week.